You're listening to Writers on Writing, a show about the art, craft, and business of writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Hank Philippi Ryan, the USA Today best-selling author of 15 novels of suspense. She has also won multiple prestigious awards for her crime fiction, including 5 Agathas, 5 Anthonys, and the coveted Mary Higgins Clark Award. She's the on-air investigative reporter for Boston's WHDH-TV and has won 37 Emmys, 14 Edward R. Murrow Awards, and dozens of other honors for her groundbreaking journalism. Hank's novels have been named Best Thrillers of the Year by Library Journal, New York Post, BookBub, Pop Sugar, Real Simple Magazine, and others. Hank lives near Boston with her husband, a renowned criminal defense and civil rights attorney. Her new book is One Wrong Word, twisty, turny, nonstop story of gaslighting, manipulation, and murder. On the show, we talk about Hank's journey to writing, the crossover from broadcast journalism, voice, multiple point of views, avoiding the muddled middle, twists, pacing, and much more. And now, from my talk with Hank Philippi Ryan, author of One Wrong Word. Hank, I'm so delighted to talk with you. Would you talk a bit about how you found your way to writing?
Oh my golly, it depends, Barbara. And thank you so much for inviting me here today. This is such a classic, iconic show. So I'm really honored to be here. How writing found me, how I found writing, I just don't know. And I think it depends on how far back you want to go. I mean, if I think, did I always want to be an author? No. Did I always love reading? Absolutely so. I mean, I grew up in really rural Indiana, and my sister and I used to ride our ponies to the library to get books, and I'd fill up the saddlebags with books and read up in the hayloft of the barn behind our house. And that's where I think I fell in love with storytelling, certainly, with Nancy Drew and Sherlock Holmes. I read every single Sherlock Holmes short story and novella. And then my path sort of went to the marvelous golden age authors, Nio Marsh and Josephine Tay and Marjorie Allingham and Dorothy Sayers, and certainly Agatha Christie. And I do remember pretty clearly reading Murder on the Orient Express and how pivotal that was for me, because I did not figure out the ending. Nobody figures out the ending unless you're as smart as Agatha Christie, and none of us is as smart as Agatha Christie. But I remember thinking, and I was probably 12 or 13, thinking, wondering, how did she do that? How did she come up with that ending that was fair and satisfying and made sense, but was utterly, absolutely surprising? And I remember going back and reading the book again to see if I could figure out how she did it, sort of deconstruct the book. And at that point, I may have thought, I wonder if I could be a mystery author. I wonder if I could do that. Could I make a story that would keep people turning the pages and guessing, and then in the end, be surprised and delighted? You know, that seemed wonderful. And then part of my brain said, well, maybe it would be better to be a detective than to write about a detective. So I went to journalism, you know, I moved into journalism, but still, when you think about it, that's still writing and that's still storytelling. So our paths are weird. Our paths are strange. And I didn't come to fiction till much later in life.
Well, I'm curious because you've been an on-camera TV reporter for quite a while and you've amassed a zillion Emmys. And I wonder if you recall the moment when you said, you know, this is a novel I need to write. This is the first novel. I need to do it. It's time now. If you remember what that was like or what you were doing or what compelled you with a particular story.
I'm smiling because I do remember that. I remember it so perfectly, actually. I was at Channel 7. I'd been a television reporter for 30 years by that time. I was 55 years old, I remember. And I got an email that was a spam, and I opened this spam email by mistake. And the subject line of the email was a new refinancing deal for you. But in the body of the email was what looked like lines from a Shakespearean play. I had majored in Shakespeare. I didn't recognize the dialogue, but it looked like from that era. And I thought, why would someone send a spam labeled a new refinancing deal for you? Something that millions of people would open or millions of people would discard, with the lines from what looked like a Shakespearean era play in the body. And my brain said to me, and I know this is a writer thing, but my brain said to me, maybe it's a secret message. And I thought, secret messages in computer spam? Are you kidding me? That's a brilliant idea. That's a great idea. You know, who would be doing that and why and what would be the point and who would get killed because I don't know, it was suddenly a murder mystery. I could just see the whole thing. I could just see this book. And I went home and I said to my husband, sweetheart, I've got a great idea for a novel. I'm going to write a novel. And my darling husband, who's infinitely supportive and enthusiastic at that moment, said, sure, honey. He said, that's great. He says, do you know how to write a book? And I remember thinking, and I laugh about it now, I remember saying to him, how hard can it be? You know, I've read a million books. And I soon learned how hard it could be. But that was the moment, that random, weird, coincidental moment where I happened to open a spam email. That was the germ of my first novel. That was Prime Time, which was published, my first published novel, my first novel ever, which won the Agatha Award for Best First Mystery. And I've been writing a book every year since then.
Well, so, because you had not studied fiction writing per se, did you just have an alacrity for structure? I mean, how did you happen to write a first novel? I mean, most first novels are not published, right? I mean, usually the first novel is sort of the teaching novel. This is how we learn to write novels. We wrote one, it's in the drawer in the closet. So how is it that was it all your reading? It just kind of worked with structure. I mean, what do you
Yeah,
think?
that's a good question. Though, don't forget, at the time that I started writing Prime Time, naively thinking it wouldn't be that hard, and I'm not sure I would have continued if I had known how hard it was going to be, actually, and we can talk about that. But remember, at that time, I had been a television reporter for 30 years. And I had been a reporter for Rolling Stone magazine for a while. I'd been a radio reporter for a little while. And what those things have in common is storytelling. And every day as a reporter, I started out as a general assignment reporter and soon moved into long-form investigative reporting. And every day, every one of my stories has a structure. It has a beginning and a middle and an end. It has a character who you care about and relate to, with an important problem, an important high stakes problem that needs to be solved. You're tracking down clues and you're following leads and you're deciding what's important, deciding what people need to know. You want the good guys to win and the bad guys to get what's coming to them. And in the end, you want some justice and you want to change the world a little bit. So that's a structure. That's a structure that I used every day. And if I wasn't writing a story every day for television, I was sure thinking about it. You know, what had I learned? What did I know? Who said what? Where did this happen? How would this all go together? I mean, I don't want you to turn the channel when my stories are on TV. You know, it's so easy these days, just click, 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 and you can discard one story and find another one. So I didn't want you to turn the channel when my stories are on TV, and I don't want you to put my books down when you're reading them. And that is the same metabolism. That's the same pacing. What to leave out? What's important? What's interesting? What's enlightening? What's entertaining? What do people care about? What will change the world? All that calculus went through my mind every day as a reporter. So it didn't seem daunting to me to write 100,000 words. It seemed like you just tell a story in a different way. It's just a bigger story that also that you just make up, that you make up. And that was my hurdle, I have to tell you, more than structure. was whether my imagination would let me, after all those years, make something up, right? For 30 years at that point, I'd only been writing the truth. I'd only been searching for the truth and writing the truth. So that was, that was a cool moment when I realized that my brain would allow me to create a new world that was kind of like our world, but wasn't our world, out of nothing but my own imagination.
I want to talk to you in a few minutes about that, about structure, about plotting or not plotting. But before we do, I would love to talk about One Wrong Word and how you knew that this book was a book you had to write. What did it begin with? Did it begin with a character, an incident, something you reported on? Where did it come from?
Well, the title came before the book, and that was kind of interesting. And then I'll tell you the saga of how the story of the title came to be. But in my book, The Houseguest, someone says to someone, one wrong word is like a guillotine. It can just kill you. And I thought, yeah, that's true. And one wrong word, that's a good title. So the title came from a fictional sentence that my fictional author said, my fictional character said. So that's pretty funny. So I had this title, One Wrong Word. So then I was thinking, what is, what is, what would one wrong word, what would that be? Rumor and scandal and gossip and betrayal and sort of the power of public opinion. How when there's a big trial, and we all devour it and we all watch it every day, whether it's OJ or Alex Murdoch or Casey Anthony, people who like that kind of story are riveted to those trials. And we all decide what we think about them. We all think, oh, he's guilty or she's guilty or she's so innocent. How could you say that? We all pick a side. And that public opinion persists even after the verdict. We don't care what the verdict said. We know that we know the truth. We've figured this out. So and as a reporter, I think that's really fascinating too, the power of public opinion. So that was what I went in to write about. Arden Ward, a crisis management expert, who's trying to repair the reputation of someone who has been acquitted of a killing, but the court of public opinion still thinks he's guilty. He's guilty and it's ruined his life. So I thought, okay, I got this. I can make that's a book. I know that's has the fullness of a novel. But then, so I'm into writing this and I'm thinking this is going well. And at one point, I just stopped. I stopped. And I thought, oh my goodness, I am writing about rumors and scandal and gossip and betrayal, but I'm really writing about myself. And that's when the book kind of changed.
So say more about that. What happened then? What happened?
Well, I remembered when I was 19 and I was working in a political campaign, and I won't use any real names except for my own. I was working in a political campaign and I was a gopher, I was a worker bee. I got coffee and I folded and stuffed news releases into envelopes for snail mail. And I was really good at that. And I loved it. I mean, I loved being in this political campaign, being sort of in the center of power. And I knew important people were making important decisions. And I was watching it all happen. And I loved it. I thought I was going to, be part of something that would change the world. So near the end of the campaign, I was in the campaign headquarters and walking down the hall. And I heard my name. And you know how we all sort of perk up when we hear our own name. And it was two campaign bigwigs talking about me. And one of them said something like, I mean, it was a long time ago, something like, have you heard about Hank and Jim? Jim has such a massive crush on Hank. Jim was the campaign manager, the biggest of the bigwigs. So, I'm in the hall and I'm thinking, this is new to me. I've never heard about this. I don't know anything about Jim having a crush on me. This is bewilderingly surprising. So meanwhile, the second guy says, yeah, everybody's talking about it and it must be true. And I've got to tell you, if Jim's wife ever gets wind of this, it's going to be a public relations disaster. And again, I'm listening to this thinking, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know about Jim's crush. And I was baffled. And so then the second guy says, what are we going to do about it? What do you think we should do about it? And the first man said, well, yes, I've been thinking about this. And I think really the only thing to do is to fire Hank. And I thought, fire me? You're going to fire me? I think Jim is your problem. I don't think I'm your problem. I was completely innocent and oblivious, and this was all news to me. And yet, they were going to fire me because I was the expendable one. Jim was the campaign manager, and they needed him. I was the gopher, and they didn't need me. So they were willing, as I was sitting here at my desk where I am right now, thinking about this what happened in the past so long ago. I was thinking they were willing to murder my reputation. They were willing to murder my reputation in order to get what they wanted. And it was so profoundly disturbing to me at the time, and it still was profoundly disturbing to me as I wrote this novel. So, and then I actually paused and thought, do I really want to tell this story? Now suddenly it's my subconscious has reminded me what this is really about and where it came from. It just sort of downloaded the memory. And I thought, do I want to do this? It's very personal. And then I thought, sure, go ahead. It's fiction. See how the story turns out. So, as the story begins, and this is not a spoiler, I think it's even on the back cover, Arden Ward gets fired unfairly. The main character, Arden Ward, gets fired unfairly because she's accused of having a scandalous affair with a powerful client. And it was really fun for me to have Arden Ward say what I should have said and do what I should have done and take back her power as if I sh the way I should have done. It was sort of a love letter to my 19-year-old self saying, it's fine. You did fine. You did the best you possibly could. And now I allowed myself to sort of knit up the raveled edge of the past in fiction. I got to fix the past through fiction. So readers, one wrong word is a fast-paced psychological cat and mouse thriller. I don't want you to be able to put the book down. I want you to miss your stop on the subway because you're reading this book. But underneath, that's the rest of the story. That's where this novel came from. And that's why it's so powerful to me. And also, interestingly, I've been on book tour for the past 6 weeks, and it's been fabulous and relentless and amazing. But there's not a stop where I speak where someone doesn't come up to me and say, this exact same thing happened to me, or this exact same thing happened to my sister, or I so know what you're talking about. Because, and it's really revealing. And my books are about the balance of power, the disequilibrium of power. And my main characters, mostly women, are taking back their power. I mean, in the end of this novel, in the end of One Wrong Word, I want you to sort of pump your fist and say, yeah, that's exactly what should have happened. And so it was an interesting journey, sort of reliving that, and rewriting the past.
Has that happened before with any of your books where there's been something very personal that you have found to pull from your life in that way?
Yes, I think that's such a great question, and I think the answer is yes, generally and specifically. I mean, I think Barbara, if you and I were each assigned to write a short story about the same thing, they would be very different, wouldn't they? Because even with the same title, because our experiences are different, our lives are different, our fears and joys and passions and wants are different. They'd be our stories only we could write. And I think my books, all of them, are stories only I could write. I mean, they're definitely not my television investigative stories made into fiction. That is what they are not. But what they are sort of an amalgam of everything. I mean, I've wired myself with hidden cameras and confronted corrupt politicians and chased down criminals and gone undercover and in disguise. You know, our stories have changed laws and changed lives and sent people to prison and gotten millions of dollars, truly millions of dollars in refunds and restitution for consumers. I've gotten people's homes out of unfair foreclosure. So I've had a lot of experiences, that would be silly not to use in a book. Of course, it would be silly. I'm really lucky to have had these, you know, decades actually of being a reporter gathering information. I mean, people say to me, "Do you do a lot of research for your novels?" And I'm like, "I've been doing research for 40 years. You know, I just didn't know that that's what it was." But what I can't put in my reporting that I can put in my novels is how I feel about it. You know, as a reporter, I'm doing an objective story, and you, the listener or viewer, you don't know whether I was afraid of the person that I talked to, how difficult it was for me to get that interview or to get that information, what I had to leave out, what I'm emphasizing, how I decided to begin it. All those underpinnings of a news story are actively hidden, and all you get is the final product. All you get is what you see on TV. So, how does a reporter feel putting that together? And my first novel is Primetime, that we talked about earlier, stars Charlotte McNally, who was a 46-year-old television reporter who was married to her job in television and worried what would happen when the camera didn't love her anymore. Now, you know, I've spent years telling people that that's not autobiographical, but of course it is. You know, of course it is. Of course, every woman in television worries what happens when the camera doesn't love her anymore. It's, you know, they're fast-paced murder mysteries, but that's, you know, that's what's the re that was what the reality, that's where that started. That was who my main character was. And as I grew as an author, One Wrong Word is book 15. As I grew as an author, the main characters became less me, way less me, not reporters anymore. Because I learned in all those years, knock on wood, how to be a writer, how to tell a story, how to delve into more of my imagination and broaden my horizons and not just write another story about somebody who's kind of like me. But there are stories about things that I care about, like justice. What does justice mean? You know, legal justice, personal justice, emotional justice, moral justice, ethical justice, you know, ugly justice, you know, is revenge justice? You know, that kind of, I think about that all the time. I also think about truth. You know, I don't mean to be all highfalutin about it, but there is a truth, and truth, is so malleable sometimes to some people. Is truth what's true, or is it what we believe, or is it what we wish, or is it what someone tells us over and over? Can we make our own truth? I mean, there is a truth. I'm a reporter. I'm always looking for the true truth. And that is elusive. My book, Trust Me, as you were asking, has anything come from a real thing? My book, Trust Me, came from a conversation that I was having with my husband at the kitchen table. My husband is a criminal defense attorney, and he was working on a big murder case. And he was practicing his closing argument at the breakfast table. And at the end of this closing argument in the murder case, I said, "Oh, sweetheart, this is, you are so good. That is so powerful. You are so persuasive. You have used all of this evidence to tell your story in the most compelling way." I said, "You know, this is, you've really done it. This is a slam dunk acquittal," I said to him. "This is a slam dunk acquittal." And then I thought about the prosecutor's wife, let's say wife, on the other side of town, practicing his, listening to her husband practice the prosecutor's closing argument in the same case. And in the end, did she say, "Oh, honey, you know, you're so persuasive, you're so compelling, you've used all this evidence in exact to tell exactly the story that you want"? Did she say, "This is a slam dunk conviction," at the same time I was saying, "This is a slam dunk acquittal"? And I realized how much of our lives is all about who tells a better story, who tells a more believable story, who tells a story that's the most sounds like truth. But I realized there are three sides to every story. There's yours, there's mine, and there's the truth, because there is a truth. And that's what my book, Trust Me, is about, those three sides to every story. And I have to say, almost all my books are about that, about truth and the search for truth and justice and the search for justice, and also about women in and power, women getting that, taking their power back.
Before we bring Hank back on, a few words about Patreon. Patreon is how you can help Marie and me to continue bringing the show to you. If you've gleaned anything from the show that's helped you along your writing path, please consider becoming a patron. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/writersonwriting. And buying your books at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting also helps us and indie bookstores. On our page, you'll find books by authors who've been on the show, as well as books Marie and I recommend. And now, more with Hank Philippi Ryan. So, one wrong word. I want to ask you a few specific things about the book. And one is that it begins with a very short chapter that is not called a prologue, but is just a very short chapter at the very beginning of the book. And then part one, and we get into sort of the story, right? The meat of the book. Why? So do you consider that a prologue? And if so, call it a prologue.
Oh, golly, you know, writers on writing, right? This is where we get in. This is where we get into those kinds of decisions that, you know, in retrospect, did I decide? Okay, you know, this makes, you're making me sound like I had a plan. You know, did I have a plan? I didn't have a plan. I never have a plan. We can talk about that. But the opening of One Wrong Word is the voice of Cordelia Bannister. Cordelia Bannister is the wife of Ned Bannister, who has been acquitted in a drunk driving fatality. But as I was saying, even though he's been acquitted, the court of public opinion thinks Ned is guilty, and that has ruined Ned's life, and that has ruined Cordelia's life, and that has ruined the lives of their two adorable children. And I wanted, so I had started the book with chapter one with Cordelia, with the scene we read now. They are waiting for the jury's verdict in Ned Bannister's drunk driving fatality trial. And Ned is insisting that he didn't do it, that he didn't see the person that he hit, and that he just couldn't have done it, and he wasn't drunk. And Cordelia is reassuring him, you know, it'll be fine, everything will be fine. And that was initially chapter one. And I love that scene. But my book is told from three points of view: Cordelia's and Arden Ward, the crisis management expert, and Monell Churchwood, who is the district attorney, assistant district attorney, who wants Ned in prison. She wants him convicted. And she's worked for a long time to prove that Ned Bannister is guilty. So finally, here's the answer to your question. I wanted to start with that scene, but I wanted Arden Ward to be the main character. I wanted the reader to understand that Arden Ward is driving this train, that this is an Arden Ward book, even though there are two other points of view. So if I started chapter one with Cordelia, my thought was that the reader's expectation would be that Cordelia is the main character and that this book will be on the train essentially with Cordelia. And you aren't. You're on the train with Arden Ward. And so how, I wondered, was I going to separate, how was I going to communicate, let me put it that way, how was I going to communicate with the reader, this is something you need to know, but she's not the main character, but this, you need to know this situation before I start. So I just took a little slice of life, a little snapshot in time, and just offered that to the reader as sort of a way of saying, here's where you are. Here's the world you're in now. Here's a real inside look at what's happening. And then the book starts. I mean, I think those kinds of labels like prologue or chapter one are the way that an author communicates to the reader, here's where you are in this narrative. Here's, I understand what it's like to be a reader. And I want my novels to be incredibly clear about where you are in the book. So, those are signposts for my reader. So if it doesn't say prologue, a prologue to me is something that. And now we're really in the weeds, Barbara. Okay, but here we go. A prologue to me is something that happened before this, way before the story, the book starts, or in a completely different situation from the book. It's not something that's going to happen later in the book that you're going to reprise later in the book, that you just put at the front so your readers will think it's really exciting when really it isn't. Chapter one becomes a disappointment. So I don't want chapter one to be a disappointment. I want chapter one to be big and good, but this didn't feel like chapter one. So I'm saying to the reader, it's not a prologue. It's just a thing. Just read this, but no, it isn't chapter one. And all that. And I can explain it now, although I thought of it in a second. I thought of it in a flash when I was doing it.
That's great. No, it
Does
worked
it make
really.
sense? Does that make sense to
Makes
you?
sense. And it worked so well. It
Oh,
worked.
thank you.
And I'm thinking of a workshop you've given about the muddled middle, right? You know a lot about getting through that middle portion. But I'm curious. If you plot, I mean, are you a plotter? And so when you know what's going to happen, you know the midpoint, and are you thinking, okay, I got to get to the midpoint. The midpoint is the tent pole holding up the middle of the book. And so the first plot point, midpoint. I mean, are you thinking of structure that way? Do you know where you're going? Do you know where you're going? Did you know where one wrong word was going to end? All of that in one question.
Yeah, no, I get you. There's not a day that goes by that I don't wish I had all that. I mean, there is not a day that goes by where I don't think, oh, I wish I could write an outline. I wish I knew what I was doing. I wish I knew who died. I wish I knew who did it. I don't know. I don't know anything. I don't know anything. And so I have this understanding of structure. I know how long a book is. I know the rhythm of a book. I know what the middle has to feel like. I know that something has to always be happening. I know that a good novel, and you're talking about the middle, and I think that's so appropriate for this. A good novel is someone wants something, and we understand why, and then they decide what to do to get that thing, and then they do that. And then there's an obstacle. Somebody stops them on their path to the thing. So then they have to rethink what they want and how to get there, and understand why. And then they re-decide what to do next. They take a different turn and they try again. There's the action. They try something again and it doesn't work, or it does work. And then they have to go from there. So it's a series of decisions. I think a book is all about causation. Something happens because of something. It's a series of decisions. And in those decisions, and a character's psychology is revealed in those decisions. Can't talk at all. A character's psychology is revealed in those decisions. Do they make the wise, benevolent, charitable, selfless decision? Or do they decide something that's ugly and venal and illegal and mean and selfish and bad. So we, in those decisions, we, the readers, begin to understand who the characters are and who to root for and who's good and who's bad. So my books are all about a series of decisions by the main character in parallel with a series of decisions by the antagonist and by the other characters in the novel. And all those decision-making processes are going on at the same time, but co and colliding. And sometimes the obstacle in the process is the other person's action. Does that make any sense? And so I just see what happens next. I ask myself at every turn, what does someone want and how far will they go to get it? Let's see what they decide now and what they decide to do something. And then everybody else in the book reacts to that because the whole book is always there. Nobody in the novel is operating in a vacuum, right? They're in this book, in this world with everybody. So everything that everyone decides has an effect on everybody else and makes them have to swivel and pivot and decide and regroup and persuade and shepherd and convince and all those kinds of things. And that's what makes the story progress. I write thrillers where people get killed, not violently and not bloodily and not disgustingly, but there is murder. There are murders in every one of them. And when you have a murder and someone has decided to kill someone, you know, aside from in defense of another, or in self-defense or in a war, you know, I think about, sadly, all the time, what could make a person violently angry enough to actually kill someone else? Like, there's no other way out. That's what you're going to do. And so my books are sort of also, One Wrong Word included, are also sort of trying to investigate why someone's motivation would be strong enough to kill someone else. And then the main character is trying to figure out what that motivation is. And that leads them to the solution of the crime. Sadly, I don't know that when I start. And so, you know, I get about 7/8 of the way through the book. I have this great story that's twisty and turny and surprising and full of reveals. And it's all wonderful. But then, you know, you at some point, you got to like cut bait and you got to decide who's the bad guy. You know, how did this really happen and why? And that's the worst, that's the most difficult part of writing for me is like I'm just whining, you know, I'm writhing on the couch, whining to my husband, you know, this isn't going to work. You know, I say, maybe I've created a crime that I don't know how to solve. You know, what if I can't find the answer? Mm-hmm. But so far, so good on that. I'm in the midst of, I'm writing book 16 right now. And what happens is at some point, all the little Rubik's Cube pieces of the book that I've put in for some reason that I don't know, go and they click into place. And I think, oh, that's what happened. That's what happened. Wow, I didn't see that coming. But it all makes sense. And that is that moment, that Rubik's Cube clicking into place moment that I search for, hope for in every novel. But no, and in the world's longest answer to your question, I have no idea what's going to happen until I write the next line and the next paragraph and the next scene. It's a surprise. I surprise myself every day. I surprise myself every day. And Sue Grafton used to call that the magic. That's the magic of writing, that we can just make something up and have it make sense and even surprise ourselves.
So do you ever hit a wall and you don't know what's going to happen next and you're sitting there and you're just like, I don't know. And if you do, what do you do then? What do
daily.
You do?
Daily. Are you kidding me? That happens daily. Of course it does. It happens, of course. And I ask myself, what does someone want here? What mm-hmm. does someone want? What would I say, what would someone really do? What would someone really think? How would they really assess this situation? Because in my book, they are real people, right? They're real people. And so they're going to do what a real person does. So I just put myself back into their real life and think, what are they doing here? What do they want here? What do they expect is going to happen here? What do they hope will happen here? Because we all hope, we all expect. And what if that doesn't happen? What's the worst thing that could possibly happen to them? What would that be? What would they do? What would I do then? And always, knock on wood again, this is so risky to say this, and always something appears, you know, then I think, oh, I get it. And then they just go on. And I think the hitting the wall is so important to talk about because it happens to everyone. Of course it does. If you're writing a good story, you know, of course it does. But it just means, you know, there's a great quote from Thomas Edison who allegedly said, when you think you have exhausted all of the possibilities, remember this, you haven't. And so I think about that. It's, you know, it's not that I can't think of it. It's not that it's an unsolvable problem. It's just that I haven't thought of it yet. And I will, and I have confidence that I will think of it. I have confidence that I will think of it, frankly, because I have to. You know, I just have to. And the answer is there somewhere. And the thing about writing a whole novel is Unlike in college or some or school, when you write your essay and you hand it in and the teacher says bad or good, in writing a novel, it's a whole process, you know, like it the next day you'll think of it. You know, you're somehow our writer brains ruminate over the thing. And if we don't, you know, thinking about, oh, I'm stuck, oh, I'm stuck, oh, I'm stuck, that's going to make your brain just seize up. You'll just freeze. And that's what you don't want to do. That's what I don't want to do. I just think, okay, just write anything, sister. You know, just write another bad sentence. And I just write another bad sentence and another bad sentence. Because again, unlike school, in writing a novel, you can go back and fix it. You can fix it a million times until you get the thing. So just write, I just write something. I just try it and then see if it works. And if it doesn't work, the next day I have another idea.
Do you write chronologically then?
Absolutely. I hear the, I went, who was I interviewing the other day? Mary Kubica, who says when she writes, listen to this. She says when she writes multiple points of view in a novel, she writes the one whole point of view, the whole novel, and then she writes the next person's point of view, their whole story, and then she shuffles them like cards together. And I just looked at her like, oh, honey, my brain would not do that, because what I was saying about causation. You know, you don't know the cause of why somebody does something until it happens, until it happens. So I have always written in chronological order. That's how my brain goes. That's how you tell a story. That's how the world is in chronological order. I mean, obviously, why people do things, there's a reason why people do things, their backstory, which I try to sneak in without you really noticing that I'm going back, you know, but it's my I'm really conscious constantly of forward motion of you know, we say it in journalism all the time. I'm conscious of advancing the story. Something happens, something happens, something happens, something happens because of something, something happens, and the story moves relentlessly ahead. It's, you know, I think about it all the time too, and because my books are audiobooks, the reader of my audiobook in One Wrong Word, Gail Shalon, is brilliant. And in an audiobook, if the audience is confused, if the listener is confused, it is very difficult to go back. You know, if you're thinking, who's that guy? Or where are they? You're going to be very unhappy when you try to rewind. So I keep that in mind as well, that an audiobook is moving relentlessly forward and my story is moving relentlessly forward. And I want to make sure that at every single moment, the reader is grounded in where they are and who's talking and is clear about what's happening. So thinking about audiobooks has really changed the way my brain works in writing physical books.
Well, you mentioned sneaking in backstory, which is, horrendous, right? It can just stop a plot, stop a story from going forward. So when you say you sneak it in, because I noticed, in One Wrong Word, there is backstory, but there's very little, but just enough. And so maybe talk about sneaking it in, like when you need it. I mean, backstory needs to come when you absolutely need it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if you and I went out to lunch and I said, listen to what happened to me today, you would not say, no, you have to tell me what happened to you for the whole rest of your whole previous life before you tell me what happened today. You don't need to know that, right? You just lean forward and say, tell me, you know, tell me what happened today. So as I'm telling you what happened today, and now this is just off the top of my head, I might say, I was walking down the street and it looked just like that street where I grew up in Indiana. You know, the sycamore trees and, you know, there was a little dog outside. It was so weird. It was just like Indiana. And so I was walking down the street and a police car just careened around the corner. So, of course, you know me and I just followed the police car. And so now you know I grew up in, now what I've just told you is that I grew up in Indiana. There was a, you know, I lived on a little street in Indiana. There was a dog. But in the process of telling the story, I mean, that was probably a terrible example, but in the process of telling the story, I sneak in little details. You know, I used to have an Irish setter. That kind of thing. I've never liked swimming since the time my cousin almost drowned. That's all you need to know about it. If you say, I never liked swimming since the time my husband almost drowned in Lake Maxincuckee in Indiana, there you get another picture. So the more work you can make each word do, and the more layers you can make each word have, you're easing in the backstory just by the choice of words, almost by not adding any more words, but just using better words, more specific words, more evocative words. That can get backstory in all the time. If
That's
someone
great.
says, I put on my pearl necklace is, I put on grandma's pearl necklace, or I put on, the mom's pearl necklace that I never take off. You still see the necklace, but you get a relationship, and
Right.
you're not saying, oh, and she gave it to me when I graduated from college, and I've never taken it off except that time I hated pearls and when I worked in the, you don't need all that. You
No.
just don't need all that.
Mom was important.
Yeah, mom was important
And that's what's
and
important.
loved her and loved her, right?
Right.
Because she gave her the pearls, the
Right.
heirloom pearls, and she's in a family that has lineage, and you can you just you know the you
That's a
drop.
great lesson. That's a great lesson, really. That's a great, perfect, perfect. Everybody out there, pay attention to that because I just learned something here.
Oh.
That's great. But since this is Writers on Writing, we talk like a little bit about business. And before we go, I want to ask you what you would say to a writer who, like you have a career at this point, you have fans, you don't have to worry about the marketplace, right? Well,
You're not seeing me, but I'm laughing. I am just laughing. Okay, but go on.
mean, especially I think debut authors or new authors are constantly worried about categories and the market, and are they, what genre am I writing in, and how do I write my query letter, and how would you tell writers to keep the marketplace out of their workplace, as they're writing? Like, how do you just separate yourself? You go, just focus on the book. I mean, that's easy to say, but
Yeah, I think it's com I don't think it's not, I almost said it's complicated. It's not complicated, but it's a balance because you can't, and I'm going to say this too, you can't really ignore some of the marketplace because I think you do that at your peril. I think a debut, any writer needs to know what genre they're writing. They need to know that because there are conventions of that, a paranormal or a police procedural or a psychological thriller like I write. A reader who wants that kind of book has expectations for that book. And, how angry would you be if you saw psychological thriller on the cover and then inside there were vampires and you're like, wait a minute, there can't be vampires in this. That's not what I wanted. This is not what I expected. So I think working in a convention, in a genre, you have to know that. You have to know what you're writing because it dictates how the story will unfold, what the sound of that story will be, what the outcome even of that story will be, how people will speak and what they'll want and what the stakes will be. For instance, I had a student who was writing a cozy, cozies take place in a little town and everybody knows each other and the main character is usually an amateur sleuth, and it's there's no graphic sex and no graphic violence and no inappropriate language and it's all little, it's cozy. That's why they called cozy. And she had written this book, this cozy with all those elements, but that the bad guys were terrorists who were trying to blow up the power grid. And I said, you see how that doesn't fit? That's not a cozy element. That's a thriller element. That's a different book than you're writing. And I think that kind of realization of what your book is wonderfully helpful because this is going to sound so silly because then it's not anything else. It's only that you're writing a spy thriller and everything that isn't spy thriller, don't put in that book. And everything that is spy thriller, put that in because you're making a contract with the reader this is the kind of book I'm writing for you. And I understand the conventions and I understand what you need and I understand what this cover is going to look like. And I understand that you're going to like this. I know you and I'm giving you what you want. So I think that's important. I also think on the other side, or, you know, parallel, is that you need to, and you also need to, and forgive me, but you also need to know what a book is. You know, I read so many manuscripts from people, and some of them are genius and wonderful, and it's thrilling to see new talent. Sometimes I want to say to them, have you ever read a book? Because this isn't like a book. You know, a book has scenes, a book has chapters. You know, there was one person who I whose manuscript I kind of read part of, and I said, you know, I'm so sorry, I'm up to chapter 3, and I don't know who the main character is. And she said, well, then you just don't understand it. And I'm like, yeah, I don't, because, you know, I'm expecting a main character in this book. And she was demanding to do it her way. And, you know, more power to her about that. But that is never going to be a book. You know, everybody's saying like, oh, I don't have the main character. You're wrong, Hank. Go ahead. Go for it. Anything can work. I'm just saying you have to understand what a book is and the shape of a book and the rhythm of a book and the structure of a book, no matter how you. No matter what your personal story is, you can write your book any way you want to, but it still has to have this structure. I'm sure, you know, and if you're a genius, if there are outliers, there are all kinds of things. I wanted to write a novel once. I suggested to my agent that it would be only made of lists, that it was just going to be lists. And the readers could deduce from how the lists changed what was going on. And my agent said, no, you're not writing that. I still insist I could write a short story like that, but everything isn't going to work, but anything could work if you can make it work. So you have to know your genre. You have to know what a book needs to be. And then the key is just write the best book that you possibly can. Your book, it can change. It has to change. It has to grow. It has to develop. It has to be, you know, be fearless about it. Just put it on the page. Don't leave anything out. Just go for it. You can always cut. But if all those wonderful things that can happen to people, as you were saying, fans and bestsellerdom and, you know, all those wonderful things that we all want, those can only happen if you write the best, if you have a good book. They can only happen if you write the best book that you can. Nobody's going to call you and say, how's that book? Are you working on it? You know, we're waiting for it. No, they're not going to do that. It's only you. It's in your power to write the best book that you possibly can. And there's no shortcuts. There's no selling it on a partial. There's no, if you know somebody, then they can convince somebody to buy it. That's not going to happen. It's just you write that book. Don't care about anything else. Write a great book in the genre that you love. Write the kind of book you love to read. You know, that's so important. And then take the next step. Did any of that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And it made me think of people I know who don't really read much. And they want to write, you know, the book or the stories or whatever. And I'm like, read. Are you reading? Well, I'll read a book in the next couple of months. You know, I'm like, what?
But, and, you know, and I hear you, and I, you know, that is just never going to succeed. I mean, we're talking about the same thing, you know, because those people don't have the voice of a book in their head. And I don't mean the story or the voice of the author. I mean, the rhythm of what a book has to be in their genre. And there is, you know, if you don't read, I can't tell you how many books I read, millions. I couldn't do this without that. I mean, it's not just about reading a good story or recognizing good writing. It's about being in this craft that there's a way that a good book is. And the only way to find that out is to read other good books and then write your own like that, but different, you know, like a good book, but your good book. And if you don't read, you can't possibly do it. You can't possibly do it.
Finish everything you start reading.
No, I'm terrible about it. My husband and I have this, oh my golly, we are so compatible in every other way, but he insists on finishing every book that he starts. He says that he has made a deal with the author that if he starts a book, that he will finish it. And I do not, Barbara, I will admit to you, if I get, sometimes I'll read the first page and I think, no, you know, that's that little, that I, and I'm so sorry. So I'm so sorry to people who I will not mention, who I just won't go on. Sometimes I get about, you know, some way in and I think, I don't care about this at all, or I'm confused, or I'm not drawn to this, and I'm just going to read a book I love. Because when you find the book you love, that, you know, I was, what was I reading the other day? Scott Carson's Lost Man's Lane, Lost Man's Lane, something like that. Lost Man's Lane, I think that's what it is. Scott Carson is Michael Corrida. And I did not do my taxes when I was supposed to be doing my taxes because I was reading Lost Man's Lane. And that's, you know, that's the kind of book that I'm going to continue to read. I'll tell you and your listeners that when my husband, I'll say to my husband, how do you like that book? And he says, yeah, I don't know. I don't like it. And I say, well, are you going to finish it? And he's like, yeah, I'm going to have to finish it. And so I hide them. I just take them and hide them. And the next day he'll say, where's my book? And I say, it's gone. You have to start a new one. So I'm doing it for his own good.
Oh, well, before we go, two things. The first is I think you're involved with, I think I learned through you somehow that you're involved with Jungle Red Writers. Will you
I'm a
tell us?
founder. I'm a founder of Jungle Red Writers. It's a blog with seven mystery authors. We've been together for 15 years. We have had a blog every day for 15 years. And it's me and Reese Bowen and Deborah Crombie and Hallie Efren and Lucy Burdett and Jen McKinley and Julia Spencer Fleming. It's wonderful. I can't believe we've gone on together for so long, but it is still going strong. Jungle Red Writers.
And that's how they find it, right? Just Jungle
Yep,
Red Writers.
jungleredwriters.com. Yes.
And in closing, I wonder if you would offer any tips or advice for the listeners who are working their way through a novel. Anything we haven't talked about, perhaps?
Well, yeah, there's a, first of all, come to my website, hankphillippiryan.com, and click on contact, and you can sign up for my newsletter. And if you just mention this show, if you want to send me an email, I'm happy to answer any of your questions. But I would say when I was writing my first novel, Prime Time, I really was stalled in the middle of it. And I, you know, I just really had no idea what I was doing. And I was aware of that. But I wanted to write the novel. So I called my mom, as we do if we're lucky. And I said, you know, Mom, I love this book. I love writing this. I think it's going to be really, really great. But I just am not sure I can finish it. And my mom paused. And then she said, well, dear, you will if you want to. And I thought, you will if you want to. And I realized that it was all about my passion and my determination and my obsession. You know, we all make things happen when we want them to happen. If we have a will, if we want to, we'll do it. You know, you move mountains. And if I said to you, you will finish this book and you will love it, I promise you, just go do it. Just persevere through the obstacles and through the day, bad writing days. You know, everybody has bad writing days. It's not that you're a bad writer, you're just having a bad day. Just go on, and you'll finish it if you want to. It is in your power to do it. Just channel my mom. Just channel Hank's mom when you're writing, and she'll tell you you will finish it if you want to.
Thank you so much. Thank you for writing One Wrong Word and for being here. It's been
Well,
delightful.
thank you. I'm working on book 16 right now on the revisions. And I always learn something when I talk to you, and I always learn something in these sessions. So I'm very grateful for being here today. Your questions are marvelous.
Thank you, Hank. That was Hank Philippi Ryan, author of One Wrong Word. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen, and a huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who help make this show possible.
I have a Substack page called Pen on Fire, where I talk about writing and I talk to authors and agents, many of whom have been on the show. Thank you, Travis Barrett, for your music and sound editing. And if you like the music you hear on the show, you can find more typewriter music on Spotify under the artist Just My Type. Travis also has original music on Spotify under his name, Travis Barrett. You can access our archive of shows, thousands by now, at writersonwriting.com. And if you want to get in touch, email writersonwritingpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach Travis Barrett at travisbarrettcreative@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. And in the meantime, stay in the chair.